Hello everybody, welcome along to How Does Technology Create Society? This is a panel about writing and world building and cool stuff and what we do with it. I'm Stephanie, member of the committee. I'm just a person. I'm a professional technical and business writer, but I don't do fiction unless you count the marketing work that I do. I do fiction. Yeah, okay. Brave New World stuff. Please buy it now. We have our guest of honour, Richard Morgan. Okay, Perky, can you do the official introduction? Stormed onto the scene with salted carbon.
I'm sure I could just play it back from the recording.
Okay, we'll
stormed onto the scene.
Rapid fire,
etc.
Still remains.
You could take that as read, yes.
It works, just go over it sort of thing. Okay. And PRK, our lovely chair, is an MBA.
And a geek.
And a geek, yes. See? Frightening combination of business and technology skills.
Good lord. Well, frightening combination of skills and a person who makes stuff up. That's a bit worrying, actually.
I think we're a nice amalgam of a skill set there. We could charge a fortune by the hour. So, the genesis of this panel initially was a compare and contrast between Altered Carbon and Sean Williams' Resurrected Man. And Sean was going to actually be here on the panel instead of me. He's having minor surgery, so he couldn't come along.
But feeble excuse.
And he's in a different state. Yeah. He was going to fly and come in. So the genesis of this is that in Resurrected Man, there will be spoilers here, by the way. If you don't want spoilers for Altered Carbon, you haven't read it already. Resurrected Man, on your way.
Okay. Stick your fingers in your ears now, and
I'm not listening. I'm listening. In Resurrected Man, Sean introduces a transporter technology that's reasonably in the middle stages of being established in the culture as being usable. You Star Trek dissolve, recreate people at the other end, but it's only just been introduced that this technology can be used to bring people back from the dead. The last stored copy of their physical pattern can be used to rebuild them again. So it's the rise and resurrection. And so it's the first time that you have the implication that death is temporary.
It's an inconvenience.
It's an inconvenience. Yes.
There are same points.
Is that yes? If you've been stored and you have the insurance payments up, that if, or in terms of police, they're covered. That if you shoot a policeman, it's just giving you time to get away. It's not killing them. But it's a very, very new idea. So people are still a bit squeamish about the whole idea of killing people being killed because they haven't got over that. Whereas in Altered Carbon. There's an opportunity. So, being shot as long as you don't have bits of your spine hacked out, blown apart, and you're not Catholic, and so on. But there's an accepted culture of resurrection, if you like. So this technology in a slightly different form, but ultimately the same. There's a copy of you somewhere, and we can rebuild you. It's part of the culture. So, but that's not. Neither of these things are used as the actual plot. They become it's background to colour in what the people are like. So, they're used to demonstrate how society has developed, or the point at which society finds itself in relationship to the technology. But it's not about the nuts and bolts. It's the fact that something is new or established, it's ubiquitous. Mobile phones are a good example of this sort of thing. Is it a brand new, ooh, exciting device, or is it something everybody has? Have we developed an etiquette for it, or is it still something new and we're still figuring out how it's used? And writing a story about that is not necessarily interesting, but having a background where, everyone's got one, my grandmother's got one, the two-year-old's got one. As opposed to just the geeks having something.
Yeah.
So that's that kind of colour. So I shall hand over to you.
Oh, right, sorry.
At this point. You're getting comfortable with it. So that's where the panel came from, and that's what the plan is to talk about. So the how you use the technology adoption lifecycle.
Right. Okay. Well, I can talk a little bit about. Morning. I can talk a little bit about where in the cycle I like to come in, I think. And really, I'd start that with, I think, basically with the movie Alien, actually, interestingly enough. Because I think that was as defining a moment for me in deciding what kind of science fiction interested me as anything else. And there is this moment, and I think you have to think back to 1979, whenever that movie came out, and the impact that it had, because you get this sort of, there's an initial image of this spaceship from the outside, so you go, wow, it's really big. And you get inside the spaceship, and the first thing that hits you, and they say it's very hard to remember what a visceral rush that was at the time, because it was so fresh, was how old it is. It was like, my God, this place is a mess. You know, it was a brilliant, and the sheer genius of that, of it was a lived-in space. You know, there was junk lying around.
It's not cutting-edge technology.
No, absolutely not. You know, there were coffee cups standing, you know, in the next to the comms system, and it was say that if you'd been paying attention, this wasn't entirely a shock, because there was Silent Running beforehand, and I guess Dark Star to some extent as well. Although that was so low budget, you know, doesn't really apply. But but Alien really was the moment at which it really shook me. I can still remember. It shook me far more. Excellent. It shook me far more than the actual, you know, monster stuff. Yeah, which I did enjoy. But it was really that whole sense of, oh my God, this thing has been out there forever. And you know, the people who run it, for them, it's just a job. It's just a place where they work. And they're not very happy. That was the other thing, that everything breaks down and they're always whinging about. It's going to take us 4 hours to fix this, and we don't get paid enough for this work. And that whole dynamic for me, I think that was, it kind of lit me up. And I think you can probably see that in anything that I've written since. By definition, I find it hard to get interested in things when they're fresh. I like it when they're not. I like it when they've already been sort of, they're like old shoes. And I think the reason for that is because what fascinates me is the human dynamic, what humans will do with the technology. When you come in at the early end, you've got a much harder, in the sense I'm sort of quite, I think Sean has taken on a difficult task, because it's quite hard to take this technology at the front end and find out what humans will do with it, because there hasn't been the time. It's very hard. I read another book recently by Alex Irvin called...
It was called Shit.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, subtitled. Damn it, what was it called? Can't remember. Anyway, it's not about so much technology, but a change in policy where in the US prison system, they suddenly decide that they're going to offer life prisoners the opportunity to kill themselves. It's called Buyout, that's right. It's well worth a look, where they basically have the idea that these guys are in prison for the rest of their lives. It's going to be very expensive to keep them. So you get them to sign an agreement that says they agree to be executed, and in return they will be given a really large chunk of money to divest. So you know, but your buyout is worth maybe $6 million, which you then get to give to whoever you want, and it kind of empowers these people who are looking at an entire life of being raped in the showers and you know, sort of brutalized. And it's a lovely idea. It's really great. But again, he chooses to come into it at the front end. It's very much about the guy who makes this happen. And I was kind of disappointed, because it got to the part where I was just starting to get interested in it when things were starting to settle down. It's like, and that's where the book finishes. So, in a sense, I think Alex was so horrified by what he'd come up with that he wrapped it up really fast. So he's like, yeah, it's been invented and here it is, and my God, it's horrible. So, and you know, we realise it's horrible and we don't have it anymore. You know, for me, that's not where the meat is. The meat for me is like when it's been around for as long as an old shoe, and all the really nefarious and dodgy and sticky and icky things that humans have done with it. So for me, with Altered Carbon, it's not the end of the technology cycle, but it's late stage. It's the decadent phase, I suppose you could say, where people have found all sorts of things to do with it that weren't envisaged by the original designers. I mean, you know, mobile phones, I mean, it's a good case in point, that Stephanie was saying here. The most interesting thing I can think of in fictional terms about mobile phones is the really shitty conditions that the miners in Africa are in, who are digging out this very, very rare...
Tantalum,
yeah. They're digging out tantalum from the mines in the Congo under incredibly brutal conditions, all in order to fuel the this tiny little circuit in the mobile phones. Mobile phones getting thrown away. You know, they're on the slag heap, and that immediately draws me. That's where I go for, you know, thinking, hey, you could build something on this. There's a story there. That's just me. I'm a malcontent, and I find that I think it's the thing that Wib Gibson said about the interzone. You know, the street will find its own use for things. You know, you develop the technology, and then someone comes along and does something interesting with it. And for me, it's the interzone, it's the street level stuff that really sort of lights my fire. And I'm not this, you know, this is not in any way original, because this is something that Gibson himself... I mean, this was what cyberpunk was all about. I think in the early stages was, let's have a look at what does the technology look like from street level. So I think if you take on the front end, you've got a much harder job on your hands, unless you're a real sort of techno-geek type, in which case you don't mind, because actually what you're interested in is the sheer amazing technological wonderfulness of it.
That's real. Yeah. The thing about the way it works is, if you're the first thing to do product, yes, you're outside the product lifecycle, so you can get disgustingly high gross margins selling to geeks who like early adopting, but also you've got all the political, environmental, social, technological and legal risk in your first version of the product, which means it's very high risk, because there's all these interest groups of lawyers and etc. etc. But it's potentially very high returns, because you can sell to the geeks with disgusting margins, and if you can keep product improvement and replace it with the next version and next version and next version, you can basically maintain a competitive advantage in that product range until that product is superseded by new technology.
But it's not a continuous life cycle. You have the classic high-tech marketing work called crossing the chasm, which means you have that enormous gap between the early adopters and a product becoming ubiquitous and cheap. Is it because probably no one in this room qualifies on the other side, but it's the when the technology passes beyond the geeky, interesting, expensive phase. It's when everyone has a microwave, and everyone has a DVD player, and everyone has a mobile phone now. But early on, they didn't. Or access too. But Western, well-funded. Thank you, everyone. But the sort of questions that you can ask yourself when you're trying to decide what your society looks like and how long it's been around, and using gadgets as an example, is the idea of, have people had enough time with the technology to form opinions about it or change their behaviour or the attitude? And again, the example is the mobile phone etiquette. Questions. All right. Who's got a mobile phone with them right now? Mine's in my room. All right, is it turned off? Yes. Or silent? Brief pause for a quick...
Of course it is.
All right, what would you do if your own phone rang? How would you feel? How would you respond?
Quickly switch on and look at some really
good questions. Yeah. Hopefully there will be some form of embarrassment and suicide response will be run from me, if nothing else. Okay, what would your response be if somebody else's phone rang?
It's usually glaring.
Okay, that would be glaring, and you wouldn't accept.
Well, just a smug grin.
Because
especially when you're dialing the
smug grin while you check your own phone to make sure it's working.
Yes, right.
But what we have now is an expectation that everyone knows what mobile phone etiquette is about, and that you have them turned off, you don't talk loudly, you don't misbehave them. If you go back, 30 years, maybe 20 years, when all you have is real estate agents and annoying loud people with mobile phones, if one went off in a cinema or a restaurant. That's actually, it was probably more common back then in comparison to the numbers, if you like. So the proportion of phones that were going through public because people weren't trained to, the owners weren't trained to have the effects, and there would be amusement, or in the very early days, there would be, what the hell was that sound?
Or smugness.
Well, I'm going to say, because it was cool to have a mobile phone, because
before it was cool, it was extremely wanky. the brick
when I say cool, I'm using that in an ambivalent way. But it was by having a mobile phone, you were making a statement about yourself, which now the only statement you're making is, I'm human.
And that's the point, is what does that make? The ownership of a particular product, what does that say about character? What does that say about society they live in? Is it fresh technology, it's unusual, or is it ubiquitous and there is a culture and an etiquette around it? It doesn't matter how it works or what it does, you don't have to know the technology of it.
Good question, and you have the answer, I think.
Sorry, yes.
I was just putting out another consideration where you get a dichotomy between two different cultures. I know when mobile phones started to become more prevalent, you started to get, particularly in some third world countries and parts of Africa, so you got more mobile phones existing than landlines.
Yeah.
And so you
so it's easier to put in?
Well, yes, it's much easier. If people would sit on the street and they would sell you to use their phone for a phone. It's just this, you've got this this technology that is somehow more accessible, easier to implement, and it starts to, it creates a dichotomy where you've got this one culture that's always had landline. They all know what it is, and you've got this other culture that's only ever really known the mobiles.
Mm.
And there's sort of the...
has to be that gap.
Yeah, you get this gap between rich and poor, but it doesn't quite work because you've got the rich people still have the poor technology, and you've got the poor people getting the newer technology.
So it's more the gap in the development and the availability of the technology. Yeah. They've skipped the steam age and gone straight to space flight. So that's sort of
mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Where you're getting a culture.
And one reason for that is a lot of those developing countries have very low penetration of fixed line phones, partly because the tech hadn't reached them, but partly because they had a phone company that was either government owned or was a monopoly and was enormously corrupt and incompetent. And so getting a fixed line phone took a really, really long time. But the mobile phones were brought in by other competitor companies who were in a competitive environment and had to not suck it to survive.
And that gives you the political background without
exactly.
The technology itself doesn't actually matter. It's the fact that
it's under somebody else's control.
Well, I think that's one of the sort of, you know, the interesting things about the way we look at technology, because I think there was a period quite a long way back now where technology was seen as the answer. And then we went through the sort of the opposing thing where it's like, oh no, it won't be the answer, it's going to make things awful, the rest of it. And I think we've reached a point of equilibrium now where we're getting a lot more comfortable. But what's interesting is exactly this dynamic where it's like, you know, the great thing about technology is it's actually empowering at an individual level. And that's the real, I think, you know, leaving aside the big stuff like, you know, the Terminator seed and you know, surveillance systems and all the stuff that's top down and huge, what I think is in a sense almost providing a counterforce to that is this idea that technology has suddenly become handheld and cuddly. I was saying this about Macintosh computers the other day; they look cuddly. And it's, so we have balance.
They have to look cuddly, otherwise
they're shiny.
Yes, and so you've in a sense we've reached our own point of equilibrium. We've got where both. Emotional tendencies in humans have actually balanced out against each other now, and you can literally, the thing that it's very hard to get people to do about anything is to say, well, it depends, you know. And now we can actually do that with technology.
And I want to say it depends, but it's empowering not only personally but also for big organisations. The mobile phone is very empowering for individuals, but the computer and cheap technology enables surveillance for the big players. And there's lots of places where it empowers.
But it's still, I mean, I had a German postgrad student get in touch with me last year she's doing some kind of thesis on cyberpunk and post-cyberpunk or something like that, and she actually got to Gibson. She said, oh, I'm interviewing William Gibson, I wonder if I could interview you. And, nice psychology. of course you can. But what I found fascinating was that she was still, and she was coming out of the sort of humanities side of a German university, there was still this really weird anti-techno vibe going on about, you know, do you think we will become the slaves of technology in the future and stuff like that? And this huge concern that technology was kind of dehumanizing people. So I think it's interesting, there is certainly in some places, there's still a huge lag on, you know, and I think Gibson has been saying for since at least the late 80s, he's been saying the technology is neutral. You know, it's not evil, it's not good, it's not what, it's neutral, it just depends what you do with it. But and that's such a, you know, it's such a truism, but it's amazing how hard it is to get some people to realise that, you know. But, sorry,
yeah. You had a question?
Yeah, I was just thinking, going back a bit, the mobile phones is a good example of, in poorer countries, a good example of the technology being taken to something that's, you know, a different consequence. You get this in Southeast Asia, like Laos, where you have the small villages, they're still on the huts made of reeds and on stilts. And they'll have a satellite dish in the middle of the village, and everyone has a mobile. And what they'll do is they'll actually, if they're taking stuff to market, they'll ring up the markets and ask what you need, what things are on, you know, going to sell well. So they know what stuff to be able to take. So that actually they changed the tribal economy, or the village economy, without a mobile phone. Even though the basis of the economy is still what it's been for several thousand years.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's clearly an introduced technology because you don't have the lineage behind it, so you know that that society has been corrupted or contacted or improved or whatever you like by someone else, because they, obviously that didn't come from
it's
there.
It's different consequence.
Yes, but it's adapted and used.
You do get culture aspects. I mean, those people may prefer their wooden houses on stilts. That's what they've always had. And because the mobile phones, while they are seen as Western technology, they're less culturally alien in the sense that all the people that they know are using it as well, their governments, their the big cities, etc. So and their people are producing it. So it's not like they're buying a piece of Western culture, they're buying a piece of something that they've taken from Western culture and developed. So it's more comfortable sort of to use that.
It's purely as a tool, not necessarily as a piece of culture.
But it also has an immediate obvious benefit. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you go to some countries where having a toilet is a status symbol, they may get a toilet because it is a status symbol, but then they still go pee in the backyard because it is a status symbol, but there is not an obvious use that if you use this, you will be
healthier
because
China, they get a toilet,
but
they don't actually have
a
sewage system connected up to.
Sorry, I think we had a question from Christopher over here.
Yeah, I just come to you on just the way technology is introduced and people get to grips with it. Now, the television series The Wire, well, not genre, does a very good job of, you know, what people do with mobile phones. So, certainly in season two, I think it is, suddenly the drug lords start using disposable mobile phones, that they'll buy a new set every week to get around the wiretaps. And the police are like, that, what do we do? We've never come up with this concept before, and they're trying to get information out of the telcos, or is there any way we can get access to this? And it takes 3 weeks to get a wiretap order, and by that time, the phone they're trying to tap is...
Well, they're buying them in packs of six, aren't they? And just, like, phone throw away.
There's a quest to buy phones from, like, seven different delis and scattered around the countryside, so they can't even quite have a single supplier. For non-genre, it's a work in the very good job, introduction of technology and it being used in ways that are unexpected.
But again, that makes for fascinating human fiction.
Absolutely.
Whereas if the mobile phones had only just been introduced, you know, only Mulder and Scully would have them. And they're kind of dull people after a while, you know. You had a question for me.
Yeah, although I'm a total Luddite, I'm also a teacher. And I teach 9-year-olds this year, which means they know more about technology than I do. And it's interesting, the way we teach now is very different from the way we taught 20 years ago. Now, I present the children with a challenge or a problem and say, go for it. And if the computers are not switched on, then I'll say, Jack, get the computers on, please, darling. Yes, and who knows how to get onto Google? Oh, good. Okay.
I won't have to bother.
Who can show Chris how to find about Anzac Day, and who can show Mary how to find out what happened actually in 1950? Wonderful. Peer teaching. Excellent. And technology.
And who can show me how?
One of the projects that I gave to my year sixes a few years ago was to make an instruction book on how to use Windows and how to, from the point of turning the computers on, and they had to write it as if they were writing it for a grade one. I then gave it to the year one teachers who read it aloud to their year ones, and if the year ones could do it and didn't need the year one teachers' help, because the year one teachers wouldn't have been able to help them, then that showed that the year sixes had been able to produce it effectively.
So is that technology creating society?
Getting them used to being exploited.
I think it's indicative of that's a technology. You certainly couldn't have done that kind of thing in a Victorian classroom because show Jack how the steam engine works. it's becoming much more personal basically.
And individualised.
Yeah.
There's a development on that just following on from the high school. So I've got 9-year-olds making you shut up. If you meet 16-year-old class, I'm fine. But what we're finding is not only the addition of technology, but we've also got the nanny state coming in over the top of it, where a lot of the chemistry experiments I used to do with my kids 20 years ago, we're not allowed to do anymore because one in every 400 people is actually allergic to one of the rare outcomes of this particular experiment. So we're not allowed to do it. So what we do is we go onto YouTube and find some American guy who did it in a bucket, so that it exploded like you wouldn't believe, and stick it up on the screen. Or we go on to one of the multitudinous simulation sites where somebody in some university has actually created an amazingly animated graphic simulation of this experiment and done it. So you stick that up on the screen. So we all got data projectors now. And to the point where in most of our classrooms we've got a data projector with a smart board, which is a smart board you can write on it, and it's saved as a PDF.
Wow, you've got that in your classroom.
Oh, yeah, you've got those in the classroom. Cool. And then a small whiteboard either side, which you never use. And this has happened in the last 5 years. It's a phenomenal, it's the fastest change I've ever seen.
The only trouble is, I teach physics at university. We've got the same problem. You can't do the really cool experiment. You have to use graphics and YouTube.
Splitting the atom.
And the students know how to use a lot of technology, but they don't know the fundamentals anymore. So just cross-multiplying in algebra, they can't do it.
Oh, right.
Which really stuffs up the actual mechanics of using the material that you're teaching them. You know, that they are whiz-bang at using all the software and everything, but when it comes to the understanding, they've lost that.
Which goes back to primary school, because we don't have time to teach them the basic 3 R's, because we're so busy teaching them technology and enterprise and science and...
So, bringing it back to technology and society, another question that I wanted to ask, because one of the assumptions that we made in coming up with this was that technology did create society. Now, is that a valid assumption, or is it really society that's creating technology that's then creating society? Is it a spiral? Is it a circle? Are we all doomed? Where are we going?
Yes. I think it's like most things. It is very much a symbiotic relationship. The more you look at what human dynamics, the more you see that there are never any linear or causal connections. It's all far more. It's much more. Which book was I reading? Oh yeah, I've got a great book. I recommend it if you can get hold of it. I don't know if it's just come out in the UK. I don't know if it'll be out here yet. Called Bad Science.
It's out here. My partner's got a copy of it. There's a new chapter that just got released online.
Really?
3 days ago.
Fantastic.
She's up to reading that now.
All right. No, it's a very fast read as well. It's by a guy called Ben Goldacre. He's actually a medical doctor, among other things. He's also a researcher. And he's basically writes for The Guardian, and he writes this column basically rubbishing what the media has to say about science, because usually they get it totally wrong. But I think at one point he said... this phrase keeps coming up, and he says, you know, in a sense, probably the slogan for this entire book, really, you know, reduced to a single sentence, would be, it's a little more complicated than that. And yeah, that's absolutely it, I think.
What I'm finding is, if you give somebody technology, they push the boundaries, or somebody will push the boundaries. So I've heard of things called no rooms, where you can have a room this size, and you can have somebody lecturing, somebody else on another campus can have people there being videoed, so you can have real-time backwards and forwards between two campuses. So now we want to produce a foundation unit across three campuses, one here, one Peel, one Rockingham. And I'm saying, right, let's turn the lecture theatre into a node room. And the techs are going, we can't do that. I said, of course you can. It's out there. Go on. So because I know it can be done on a small scale, yeah, I'm pushing them to do it on a larger scale. So I think once the technology's there, people will always be pushing the boundaries.
Well, and the other thing I think, and you won't hear me say this very often because I'm fundamentally, my politics are left liberal, but I think there's a sense of individual empowerment going on with technology which there didn't used to be. And there was this point about corrupt systems in Africa. Very much the case that the reason so much of Africa is so hideously underdeveloped is not because the potential is not there, it's because basically the people who are running it have fucked it up. And the technology is short-circuiting that aspect of human behaviour. So, in a sense, it's a tool against corruption. Because, yeah, someone like you can step in and say, I know that you're lazy and you don't want to be bothered with pushing to see if we can actually set this system up, you know, but I know it can be done because my friend down the road has already done it, so bloody well do your job.
One computer per child project,
then. Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that what you've got here?
Teach children how to use a program really, really well, how to abuse the hell out of the computers until they're broken, and generally foster an ignorance of actually the machinery while complaining at the top of their lungs that they don't have the latest and greatest to keep up to date with all their friends, and spreading viruses like nobody's business because I work in a high school and I'm the IT tech.
So do you think it should be... So what do you think? You think it should be one computer between, what, three or four maybe?
I think computers should be limited to classrooms that actually give me...
Labs.
Giving access to computers so that they are there for the children who have an interest. I mean, show kids that computers are there. They know that. They'll take it up. Mm-hmm. They want to learn. They'll use them as much as they want to, which for most of these kids, and yeah, I work at a girls' school, it's IMing, Photoshop, how to get onto MySpace, downloading music, and iTunes.
That's really wholesome compared to what's going on in the boys' school.
And
I want to jump in quickly.
I want to steer us back to the theme.
Okay.
we're drifting a bit into a general sort of conversation, but the one of the main points of this panel was supposed to be is, how do you take these concepts and these stories and these discussions and use them in writing? So what the kind of questions that you can ask yourself about, okay, you've got your transporter technology or you've got your amazing medical breakthrough or whatever. You've got your gadgety ideas.
You train replicators.
But what are the questions that you ask yourself and how do you take that concept and get from there to the consequences that form the background of your writing? So there's...
Well, for me, it's like the issue really is it does come down... Sorry. that it comes down to the human dynamic. So it will be that it's not so much that I go looking for something, it's that something will strike me.
Yes.
And that thing is usually some back-end development in the technology. Yes. Something. And by extrapolation, you're thinking, right, well, if you had something that's like that, but, you know, ultra, ultra powerful or, you know, applicable to a different aspect of existence, you know, what would that look like?
But it's the next, it's once an idea occurs to uterine replication, say, and whatever stage it might happen to be, but if you're thinking, does it come in different colours? has it been around long enough for that kind of choice to come? Is the technology in the process of kicking people out of their jobs, which would be mothers at this point, you know, have all the jobs already gone? So think about Luddites, mill workers. Are we having people protesting about the technology because it's threatening them, or is it accepted? Do typists still have jobs? Are there still personal assistants and secretaries and customer service people? Is the world of work being changed? Are teachers in the process of being replaced completely by technology?
Never.
Never. But there's plenty of science fiction around where you have computerized teacher programs. Don't appear. Indeed, I agree.
Teaching is personal.
Exactly. There are lots of bad science fiction examples around where there are trying to teach.
How easy is it to be personal with the class sizes the way they are?
Because you do.
Yeah.
If I've got 32 children in my class, I know them. I teach them. I have more contact with them than their parents do.
Yeah. That's if you get those 32 children all the time. If you've got this 32 children, and then that 32 children, and then that 32 children, the concept is
I think it comes down to the individual child and the way they learn and their humanity. Some children learn off the internet. Some people thrive on the internet, and yet you've got other people who need that humanistic touch, the real person to touch. And so it just comes down to the individual, and that comes back to society. How society will use technology or abuse technology comes down to the human aspect, human psyche. And that's where I think it comes down to your authors. How far can they bend their mind into what someone else might do?
Are the children ahead of the teachers at this point? Or eventually, eventually they'll catch up.
Usually they catch up.
I was going to say, is that how you write? You would say you're always going to have some people who embrace the technology, some people who reject the technology, some people who just use it every day. And you just sort of try to come up with how that would work, whatever your various technology.
I think this is the point that if you write from a human base, then as long as you have a pretty sharp grasp of how humans work, then any given technological development, you're immediately faced with those questions. You're going, right, well, there are going to be some people who love this, and there'll be some other people who hate it. There'll be some people for whom it really makes life a lot easier. There'll probably be a whole lot more for whom it makes life more difficult. And once those are the threads that go in, so rather than, you're really making me insecure because because all those things you mentioned, I don't ever consciously give them thought.
No, it's a constructivist technique that thinks of something you do instinctively. But it's...
Okay. Still feeling a little insecure.
You have a natural gift which other people have too.
Yes, now I feel better. It's a male ego thing, obviously.
And that's my husband, and he knows it. Dealing with my exciting phrases.
Somebody, please.
Andrew,
had his hand up.
Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say that the best thing to convey that technology is ubiquitous is not to describe it. You don't see somebody walking into a room and having a half a page on how electrons blur through wires and make a light work.
Yeah. Mm.
The classic, I have an example here, is that do you write, your character says, I will take a protein pill now, or I'll go grab dinner, and it happens to be a protein pill. It's the, what is the person doing? They're grabbing something to eat. What is it? Well, it's different from what it used to be, but it's still a human grabbing something to eat. So it's
show, don't tell.
It's show, it's absolutely. That's not the whole thing is to show, don't tell. You can throw in details if you want for some of the technology if you wish, but the point is to show how people use it, how they interact with the humans.
Yeah, and so I think that's probably the one area where coming in at the front end of the technology is easier from a fictional point of view, because if the technology is fresh, then there will be news bulletins about it, and there will be, It will be discussed. It will be. This is what happened with the Alex Irvin book, and I'm guessing it's probably true with Sean's book as well. That it's very much current. Whereas, I say, if you're at the back end of it, it's like no one talks about this stuff because it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. So it does make it a bit harder. But again, I think that it's the human thing. If you you think, well, what do humans do? How do they behave? And then you make them behave that way with the assumption technology is there. And then the reader will work it out. Yeah.
I like the concept of change management. We do it for a lot of things with a development and so forth. But with technology, we really don't look at it very far down the track. And that's where fiction can serve a purpose. it can look at both the bad side and the good side. Your book, with Old Carbon, the issue of being having an imprint and being able to be have your body taken away has got to be have serious psychological ramifications within a society. And being able, that's a punishment. So it was technology that was going to free up people. Oh, no, no, hang on. You're just stacked away somewhere hidden. You'd just be lost. Corrupt data.
Well, it was very fun, very strange. I remember someone, I can't remember now if it was an official review or it was just something somebody had written to me, or but saying, it was an American, saying they couldn't see how this would work because, after all, if criminals are just, you know, having their consciousness stored somewhere, so they're not experiencing anything, they're just stored, how is that? That's not going to happen because that's not a punishment. But it was this fascinating insight into the mindset, because it was like, look, don't you get it? For most governments, prisons are not about punishment. Prisons are about just getting rid of the problem. You know, sink it in concrete, do whatever you got to, but just get it out of the way. But yeah, very much the case that sorry, I completely lost the thread.
They wouldn't have looked down the track of what that implication was, down that track. So maybe, or maybe they did deliberately, okay, we can get rid of these people now and no one will know or worry about it. They'll be released in 20 years. How do you know it's the same person?
Yeah, how do they know that they're the same person? Yeah. I think that's the... I like the fact that the idea of human limitations on this stuff as well. Again, in Altered Carbon, there's the sense that all, you know, theoretically, everybody could live forever with this technology. Economic systems interfere to make sure it only happens to a few people. But what also interferes is the fact that the people just get fed up. Yeah. So then, you know, we're not designed to live a long time. And therefore, those who do live a long time go slightly mad. They're not really human anymore. After a couple of lifetimes, you just start to see things differently. What I found fascinating was that there's this kind of... The Kurzweil brigade, who just think everything's going to be lovely, you know. I think, I don't know if I said this to another audience, that the William Gibson describes this as the geek rapture. You know, we'll all be taken up, and you know, and that it'll be great, you know. And the idea that people have a hard time adjusting when they move from one country to another, but so, you know, oh yes, you'll be divesting yourself of your physical being and you'll exist in a mainframe computer with these dimensions and characteristics. Oh, cool. Yeah.
Duncan, did you want to
I wanted to tie together a couple of threads we've heard here. So your one about you don't know what's going to happen initially, Christopher's example of the mobile phones and the way the criminal organisations adopted them, and your example earlier about the legal risks of bringing in a new technology.
Yeah.
I think on the legal side, you actually have a huge advantage because no one knows what it's going to be used for that's nefarious or illegal, so there isn't any legislation about that. If you try to bring in a new internet now, you know, can you imagine the legislation that would be around before you could deploy that? Instead, everyone's playing catch-up because people have discovered all of the different things that they can do with it.
It's that window of opportunity before government, before regulation catches up.
And if you are keeping going faster and faster and faster, government won't catch up.
Yes. And then there's loopholes, and then you have to, and then the legislation gets more and more entangled and ridiculous as time goes by.
On the board of Electronic Frontiers Australia, which is the equivalent of the Electronic Frontier Foundation in the US. The name of the organisation comes from the idea that the internet was the uncivilised frontier. It was like the old... That's the origin of the name, the idea that the internet was like the old West. The law hadn't got there yet. And, you know, it was this uncivilised place that would gradually become civilised. And you couldn't just impose law from outside. You needed to have local lawmen who knew what they were doing.
Mm. No, that's very true. I mean, it's an organic process. Law is... I had a terrifying experience in France a little while ago. Do you want to hear about that? Okay.
I'm just going to say, with the social implications of some of the technology, when you're looking at immortal technology, I'm not sure, I can't remember if it's a company book, so I'm sorry if it was, for going over it. But if you've got the idea of a technology affecting not only a law, but a massive ethical law, is if you had a technology that allowed everyone to be immortal, everyone across the board would just live for centuries longer at least. You'd end up having to have state sanctioned suicide.
Yes.
As a guarantee, because you'd have the upper classes pushing for it. And when the RDL Plus are pushing for it when they're pushing against it. You've suddenly got a world where people will kill themselves at some point. But, well, I'm done with life. I can't die naturally because we extend our lives, so...
Yeah, yeah, no, and that comes, that, that's not, well, I kind of assumed the economics would take care of it, and, you know, they just, you know, we wouldn't allow the hoi polloi to get to any, that condition. But you're right, I mean, it's, well, it's in Future Armour, isn't it? Suicide booths.
So, you're in France.
What, sorry?
France.
All right, France. Okay, so I'll make this quick. Yeah, I was at a convention in Nantes and with William Gibson, and we were all on this panel about the future of information technology and so forth. And they made the catastrophic mistake of putting on the panel with putting an actual politician. there's a French. He actually was the Under Minister for Technological Development or something like that. And I have never heard so much shit come out of a grown man's mouth in my life. So, well, no, okay, Bush, but I mean, you know, seriously. And what he was saying was, and it was being translated for, I was simultaneous translation. But what he was saying was, you know, the challenge that faces us. Is that we have to anticipate the technology. And until now, we have been playing... Well, he didn't say playing catch-up, it was a lot clumsier than that, but he said, you know, up till now, we have been lagging behind. The technology is ahead. We come in afterwards with the legislation. And he said, we have to change that dynamic. We must learn to legislate upstream of the technology. And I did an interview about a week later with a guy in Britain who was at the convention. He said, you weren't very happy about that, were you? And I'm going, what? Was that apparent? He's going, yeah, you were sitting staring into space, grinding your chewing gum. And this guy just went on and on and on. And being a politician, he was very adept at stopping anybody else saying anything at all. But I just thought it was... And Gibson said to me afterwards, he said, you know, where I live, we look on regulation as you know, we'd like to have more of that stuff because, you know, generally it seems to work. But by God, there's a countermeasure. Just this idea, we'll upstream of the technology. How will you do that? How will you, you know? But there's a body of thought in places like France where, you know, central planning is still quite strong and the idea of government intervention has not really been tempered by the, you know, the Reaganite and the Thatcher revolutions. And they still genuinely think that, as you were saying there, that you can just come into this new frontier and just, you know, stamp something, not on what's there, but what's going to be there in 10 years' time. So, you know, people believe all sorts of Kool-Aid weirdness.
Just to make you feel a little bit more uneasy. The university I'm working at is what people think outside the box of the foundation unit we're developing is based on science fiction. So that we can drag in the ideas of all the authors and get the students to start thinking outside the box, because if you can't envisage the future, you can't get there. So having a nice, earthy feel to your future makes it feel more real, which is what you're doing. Even though you've thrown it out there quite a long way, you're still making it human, you're still putting people in there, it's not just spaceships and guns.
So you're not looking for writer in residence, are you?
Well, you know, if you want to hang around the university for a while, we probably won't pay you.
I think Guy the
Mike. I can understand where a French politician was coming from. If you can predict where certain things are going, such as the ability of the American drug lord to be able to just take a mobile phone and just use it for a week, what they're doing with telephone intercepts nowadays is to say, you actually get the warrant per person, so you don't get a specific number. Now, if they had worked out that this was where mobile phones were going, they could have brought that in at the time, rather than playing catch-up 10 years down the track, because that's how long it takes legislation to get through at times.
No, I don't... I don't dislike the aspiration, if you like, but I just think it shows a complete failure to understand how technology works.
Given a French example, the Chinese government has a massive problem with mobile phones with cameras, particularly when they take videos of Tibetan monks. They're going to have a massive problem when the video of Tibetan monk can go straight onto a foreign website without the Chinese government being able to say, no, stop that, and you locked up long time.
I don't think we even need to look at China. look what's happening here in Australia and in America, when all the new computers that come out have webcams on them. And children are encouraged to have new computers at school. And you've got, you know, 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old students with webcams. And, you know, they get up to a bit of mischief and suddenly everyone's, what's happening?
Yeah. Case in point, a couple of months back, there was a big story in the US about sending suggestive photos from your mobile phone to your friends, and there was a lawyer...
How to do it?
No, just that there were a bunch of 14-year-old girls that got caught for it, and the district attorney was threatening to charge them as sex offenders for sending photos of themselves to their friends.
Yeah, putting them on
and boyfriends.
Because they're underage, and therefore it's child pornography.
The EFF actually stepped in and got an injunction so that you couldn't do it.
But this is, again, society trying to catch up with the tech, because the early adopters are just using it in ways that people never thought of when they went to create it and make it ubiquitous.
Vanessa, I think you've had your hand up a while.
No, I was just going to say that one of the sparking off your experience with French politician, something that some countries decide to do, a la China, is to just have this huge amount of power in reserve. So instead of legislating upstream of the technology, they just wait around and they hear something and they don't like happen and they smack it really hard. As a sort of dissuasion for tactic for everybody else. So that's the other governmental alternative to legislation. Of course, that only works in countries where the government has enough power and reserve that they can afford to instead of play catch-up, do it really fast.
And it also, as I understand it, it pretty much kills your chances of getting a thriving economy going as well, because...
I
read quite an interesting book on China, because everyone's panicking about China. I don't know if they are here as well, but certainly in America and Britain, everyone's going, oh, the Chinese are coming. And there's a guy called Will Hutton, a sort of political commentator in Britain. He wrote this book about China, and he's basically just going, look, just chill the fuck out, because he said, you know all that growth? 85% of that growth is foreign corporations manufacturing in enterprise zones. That's it. They go home, China is a third world nation all over again. You know, and one of the things he's saying is exactly that. Is when you've got this massive repressive system, it's impossible to see the kind of small startup, the kind of individual that all the teachers here have been talking about. That just doesn't happen. The people who really want to do it, they'll leave, they'll escape, they'll go do it somewhere else.
Poor old Chinese are brutally oppressed by capitalism. They should have a revolution.
Actually, they're not far
off.
Yeah, Richard, you mentioned the relationship between economics and technology. I think I remember reading somewhere that you quoted as saying that the powerful will always have, they'll always get their hands on the technology and first.
It's expensive by definition.
Do you actually envisage a way in which that technology can actually become more beneficial for the rest of society, or a way of the economy perhaps moving in a way that is less geared towards power accumulating at the top?
Well, I think I'm a lot more hopeful than I was 5 years ago, certainly. I think that, and also I think it's interesting because when we think of technology, we do tend to think of electronics and, you know, sort of shiny stuff. But actually, you know, law is a technology. Economic systems, litigative systems, all these are also a form of technology. And I think one of the things that frustrates me about the left liberal constituency in my part of the world is how sort of unaware they are of the value of the soft technology that exists in the Western world. And if there's a hope, it's basically the hope that the sort of enlightenment-based legal and ethical systems that we've got woven into our society, they actually provide some kind of webbing to protect against that. And that's the area I've become most interested in where society is concerned, is understanding law as technology. And this is why I think, you know, when you approach people about things like homeland security in the US or the British are now doing it worked so well in America, we decided we'll have the same thing, is to basically say, it's the equivalent, what you're doing here is the equivalent of taking a monkey wrench to a bunch of laptops. You know, you're smashing up centuries of social technology. You're taking the legal systems that have taken decades and decades to evolve, to form a protective web, to have a way of doing stuff, and you're just slashing them to pieces. And there's a great line in, you ever seen Man Full Seasons? Jeremy Bolt, was it? Bolt, somebody Bolt, anyway. Man Full Seasons is about Sir Thomas More getting executed for refusing to toe the line. And there's a bit where he's talking to his firebrand future son-in-law, and he says something like, I would cut down every law in the land if it enabled me to pursue the devil. I would cut down every law in the land if it stood between me and the devil. And he says to him, and he says, it's a beautiful speech, and he turns around to him and says, I'm paraphrasing here, he says, yes, and when you've cut down the last law in the land and the devil turns on you, where will you hide? And I'll stop. But sorry, did I answer the question?
Yeah. I just wanted to interject at this point, because we're in danger of equating technology with electronics at this point. Technology is printing, is fire, is wheels, it could be anything. So again, thinking about your world building, we're not just talking cyberpunk here, we're not just talking electronic future. It's if you take any kind of tool or process or product of society, and it's how long has fire been around? Can fire be nasally inserted? Are there marketing executives around for it? But it's just to remember to free yourself from the concept that we're just talking laptops and internet and so on. Whatever world you're trying to build, it's whatever technology. Whatever is in active development at the time is usually labelled technology, because old technology is taken for granted. So it's how you illustrate what is already taken for granted and what is being developed at the time. That's how you illustrate how much development, where the society is.
How much we think of it as technology.
Certainly, one of the comments that my mum made, but she was basically saying that once we know how something works, not technology anymore, it just is. And so I suspect that, I was learning how to sew, and so I figured out, how the sewing machine actually, produced the stitch, and I was like, oh, okay, that's it. And suddenly it really did go in my head from this piece of technology that was over here, something that I could make, or figure out how to use.
It becomes goal-oriented, not a functional thing.
Yeah, and so things like, aircraft, or, I know the basics of how a plane flies. So that's not quite technology anymore, but microchips inside a computer have no idea. And so that to me is technology. Because I don't know how it works.
You use a plane to visit your relatives, you don't use a plane to fly.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, you're acrobatic.
All right then. A few minutes left to wrap up.
Did you want to wrap up?
No.
I've actually talked much there.
That's fine.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm quite happy to sit here and let other people talk for me. Brilliant. I will have one thing I wanted to mention again, and I'm not sure if we've covered it, but one of the things that technology does in society is actually opens up a lot of access to justice. So if you take a very low-tech community and you have your tribal overlord there or whatever, there isn't really much justice. You start to give them webcams, phones, internet connections, and suddenly their plight is everywhere. And you start to get that aspect of justice. If someone is being oppressed here, and if the media don't want to cover it, but the community does, you get that uprising, and you get that response to it. And I believe you were talking in your Guest of Honour speech about some of the islanders who were kicked off their homeland.
Mm. Yeah, although I think, does depend on who you're up against. If you're up against local warlord or the LAPD, then you sometimes have a chance. If you're up against the British and American government, forget it.
But it's still a lot harder to just keep them under the rug.
It is much harder now to hide stuff, and that's a massive improvement. The Chagos Islanders have, I really don't think they got much hope.
Yes, Minister, I disagree with that. It's a lot harder to hide it, but a lot easier to bury it.
Well, yes, that's true, of course.
Office fires.
Yeah.
Yes, we're dealing with that.
Yes, we're dealing with it. There's always this other thing. Well, it's more important, it goes in, and then we take 3 months holiday, and then it's buried.
And
it's
although we know about it, and we've seen what's happening with Tibet, and we know, oh, this is really bad, oh, it's horrible, oh, it's awful. Okay.
Yeah, I've expressed my outrage, and now, yeah.
Those islanders, they're not back on the island.
No, they won't be.
Tibetans, they've not got their freedom. We know about the atrocities that as humans are doing, and oh dear.
Well, that might be the truth of the majority, but there'll be one or two that will hear about it, that will respond, that wouldn't have known.
I think unfortunately, there comes a point when this kind of thing, it beyond resolution, and it sort of enters the archives of sort of racial indictment, if you like, where Bob Shaw, an Irish science fiction writer, I don't know if any of you read any of his stuff, there's a great one of his short stories where he says they butchered this alien race by accident and realised they were doing it, and he says, and you know, they close off the planet for the remaining females who have got to complete their life cycle and die off. And it says, and the incident was recorded in the annals of the annals of atrocities that serve the human race in place of a racial conscience. And you know, I thought that was very effective. You know, we're very good at feeling bad after the event. But
I think we're out of time at this point. So
yep.
We could thank you everyone for your